minutes after 8 o'clock. Welcome to Morning Magazine for Monday, March 21st of 2021. I am your host, Rosanna Longo-Better, in for Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up after headlines, the mass shooting tragedy in Boulder is nearing its year anniversary. We will hear how a musician survivor is still dealing with a trauma. CityCast Ember speaks with an author who reflects on the event that set a precedent for the Me Too movement. Then we will take a look at what's coming up on this afternoon's Metro show. At the bottom of the hour, we will hear the BBC headlines and then Hightower Lowdown, followed by Good Old CU with Joe Ujas. And as always, on Monday morning, it's Counter Spin at 9 a.m., a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. And then, at 9:30, we will bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. All that is still ahead this morning, but first, a look at local and regional headlines with KGNU's Ali Stackrath.
On Friday, a judge denied the request for a temporary restraining order, now allowing Boulder County to sign a contract with DRC Emergency Services for debris removal. The nonprofit group, Demanding Integrity in Government Spending, or DIGS for short, filed a lawsuit in February claiming Boulder County violated open meeting laws and was not transparent during the process of selecting a contractor for the private property debris removal program. On Tuesday, DIGS said that they are no longer asking the county to restart the bidding process. Boulder County can now sign the $52 million contract. The contract could be signed as early as tomorrow, and the debris removal process could begin as early as March 28th. People who lost their home to the Marshall Fire, were forced to evacuate, or lost the ability to work, qualify for Marshall Fire assistance up until March 31st. Boulder County will notify eligible applicants via message or phone call within 7 days of submitting their application. The county will distribute the aid through April 22nd and notify further financial assistance in the next few weeks. To apply for assistance and find additional information on eligibility requirements, you can visit boco.org/Marshall Fire Assistance. The City of Boulder has extended the Boulder Business Recovery Program, or BBRP, until August 31st. BBRP was created to support Boulder businesses through the COVID-19 pandemic and allows for businesses to extend outdoor seating areas. Businesses that are currently using the expansion do not need to reapply, but new businesses that want to utilize extra space for outdoor seating can apply through April 30th. The city is currently working with the Downtown Boulder Partnership and City Council on a post-pandemic outdoor dining pilot program. The interim director of the Community Vitality Department, Chris Jones, said the economic effects of COVID-19 continue to challenge our community, and this extension will allow participating businesses to continue their current expansions as the city works with its partners and city council to determine how the program might evolve and continue when the emergency orders do end. On Wednesday, Colorado lawmakers introduced House Bill 1288 that will provide immunity to sex workers from prostitution charges when they are reporting serious crimes. The bill would allow sex workers to safely report about 24 different crimes that include murder, assault, stalking, and human trafficking. Colorado Representative and bill sponsor Matt Soper said, "The ability to encourage someone who has actually seen these crimes or been a victim of these crimes to go ahead and come forward, it is really trying to encourage those witnesses." The bill passed unanimously through the House Judiciary Committee that includes both far-right and leftist members. They expect the bill to pass through the Capitol with little resistance. On Saturday, a backcountry skier died in an avalanche near Steamboat Springs. Dispatchers received word at 12:20 p.m. that two backcountry skiers had set off an avalanche in the Fish Creek drainage area just east of Steamboat Springs. One of the skiers was caught in the avalanche and came to rest near a tree. When their companion found them, they were no longer breathing. The companion performed CPR for close to an hour while waiting for search and rescue, but CPR unfortunately failed to save them. In today's weather, the National Weather Service forecasts around an inch of snowfall today, mostly falling before noon in Boulder, with a high of 41 degrees today, with a low of 24. Tomorrow we'll see another chance for snow in the afternoon and evening, but temperatures will begin to rise Wednesday and see sunny skies for the rest of the week. Denver should see similar weather with snowfall expected this morning and a high of 41 degrees today. Tomorrow has a forecasted high of 46 degrees with a chance of snow in the afternoon. Warmer weather is expected to follow for the rest of the week. Temperatures are expected to reach 43 degrees today in Fort Collins. Outside the Boulder studios, it's 34 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Ellie Stuckrath.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Tomorrow will be the one-year anniversary of the mass shooting at King Soopers in Boulder that took the lives of 10 people. Maddie Mueller brings us this report on one CU Boulder student who was in the building and has used music to heal.
On March 22, 2021, a gunman opened fire at a King Soopers grocery store off of Table Mesa Drive in Boulder, Colorado, and 10 people were killed. Louis Saxton, a current sophomore at the University of Colorado Boulder, talks about his experience.
So I was leaving the store as some shots started going off, and I just ran to my car. I don't know. They always talk about, like, fight, flight, and freeze, and I think I definitely fleed as best I could. Yeah. And I think partly felt incredibly lucky and also guilty that I had happened to be where I was when it happened. And that I was able to get out, and so I went back for the 10 days following to each day to honor the 10 victims. Playing for years, so I chose to play just various movements from several of the solo Bach cello suites. In particular, I think the one that resonated probably the most with everyone is the G major prelude that everybody knows. It's like the cello piece. And I think because what I like about the Bach cello suites, at least, is that they never seem to be pure happy or pure sad. They seem to just contain a lot of different emotions, and so it allows for a lot of different interpretations of people listening to it, and me playing it, honestly. And I kind of feel like music is my safe space, and my cello is my safe place, and so I wanted to be with my cello, but also to share that with other people.
As a musician, Louis is familiar with performing and attracting audiences. But in the aftermath of the shooting, he received a different kind of attention, especially from news outlets in his hometown of Bemidji, Minnesota.
It kind of sucked for a while. Felt like I couldn't really move past it without, like, someone asking me about it. I think it's felt better now. I think people are doing some amazing articles on it and stuff. But I'm hoping that eventually I just get to move past that, yeah.
The tragedy is nearing its one-year anniversary.
I don't know, I think it's brought back some feelings and stuff, but I've just tried to not really think about it too much. I think it's been good for me to keep busy and thinking about other things, so.
That report on CU music student Louis Saxton was produced by Maddie Mueller, a student at CMCI CU Boulder. Today in CityCast Denver, you will hear an interview with Erica Krause, writer of Tell Me Everything, about how CU Boulder's sexual assault scandal set a precedent for the Me Too movement.
So when most people hear about Tell Me Everything, I think they're going to hear that it's about the CU Boulder football team's sexual assault scandal of the early 2000s. But you never actually name the university you're talking about or the city that you're talking about in your book. Can you explain that choice to me?
I would love to, because I'm just a really like whistleblower type of person, but I'd love to talk about like who and when and all the bad guys, you know, and all the people who did the bad things. But what happens is when you identify a perpetrator, you inadvertently identify the survivors. So, and that was a priority for me, is to keep their privacy intact as much as I possibly could. So that was part of that decision, to keep that anonymous. People do their own sleuthing, of course, and the internet exists. So there's only so much that you can do. But I tried my best to keep those things out of the book.
Yeah. So we'll just say it's an unnamed Division I university in a foothills town near a very right. specific rock formation.
Right.
And we'll leave it at that. Right. We'll let the listeners decide what we're talking about.
Exactly.
Let's set the scene a little bit better for listeners, because this isn't straightforward reporting. It's part memoir. So can you tell us a little bit about how you became part of the investigation and part of the story here?
Sure. I never really sought out to become a private investigator. It was just a weird thing that happened in a bookstore with a lawyer. I was browsing the stacks and started talking with this lawyer, and he started just talking a lot about his personal life. And then he was very surprised that he was doing that. And I said, oh, that always happens with me. And that probably always happens with you, Peyton. You have that same face.
Oh, thanks.
Right? You have this. We're on Zoom, so I can see your face. I know people are probably like, I'll tell you everything about me. And I said, oh, well, that happens a lot. And immediately he saw a way to use that in his, benignly used that in his practice, law practice, and he hired me on the spot as a PI. But I didn't have any experience as a PI. I didn't know what I was doing. So I really flubbed my way through the first few cases. And then he got this case, this amazing, it was a Title IX sexual assault case on where a group of football players and recruits gang raped a college student. And it was, there had never been a Title IX sexual assault before. This is totally new ground. So he hired me, and it turned out, even though I had kind of failed on the first few cases, this turned out to be a fit for me. It was a case in which I sort of learned how to be a PI.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the university system. So you write quite a bit about football culture and the university system sheltering them. And you talk about all these people who at the time were stepping up to defend the football players. What was it like to go up against that in your work?
It was interesting when it was in person, because those people are big and they're scary. As one of the witnesses on the case said, their sport is to hit each other. So what are they going to do to me, right? Then you add to that the fact that, you know, a large percentage of them have brain damage because of the sport itself. I mean, it's an incredibly harmful sport. So you're dealing with someone who, under normal circumstances, might be a reasonable person, but you add, they've got mental problems, and because of their brain injuries. And then they're used to getting whatever they want because of their size. So it was like trying to learn another language to get along with someone who has such a different life from your own life, a different set of privileges and disadvantages, that you have to quickly adapt to a completely different culture. And I found myself feeling almost sucked into it at times, you know, like there's a celebrity around them, you mm-hmm. know, of course. But also I found myself pretending a lot, pretending to share their value system, pretending to, you know, believe what they believed about women, just so I could get them to say things. It was sometimes scary and sometimes thrilling. I can't really describe it.
You know, it was shocking, because that was really only 20 years ago. And those issues and themes are so common in conversation today. but it wasn't the case 20 years ago when the scandal was playing out. So what surprised you about looking back at the story post the Me Too movement?
It's very different now in really good ways. I mean, the same things are happening. Let's face it, like football teams in colleges are geared toward winning and whatever it takes, right, is often the mentality, especially in certain states. So not a lot has changed in certain practices, but what has changed is the eye on it, the understanding of it. Before this case, there wasn't really the understanding that a school's responsible for what their team does. It was like, well, oh, those are individual criminals. Those are individual people who committed those crimes. And are they really crimes? You know, there's a sort of attitude like, well, you know, is this really what happened? Or can we even believe these women? Or maybe they just want to be with a football player and they get upset afterwards at their own behavior or something like that, was the attitude I kept coming across. But definitely since Me Too, there's been a movement really toward believing women. So I think there's just a much better understanding now. So what's ending up happening is on the back end, there's better enforcement of the law on the back end. People are feeling a little braver to come forward, I hope, since this case and all the subsequent sexual assault Title IX cases, because it's no longer this new ground, it's no longer this, like, you know, oh, well, it's your fault, you shouldn't have been there in the first place, right, kind of idea.
So the case, at the end, no one was charged. No one really got punished. It seemed like nothing really happened except the girls who stepped forward, their lives got turned upside down. So what were you hoping for in writing this book now?
Well, some things did change. Well, a lot of things did change, actually. Law changed, right? The NCAA, they changed their rules. That university changed their policies, and they actually became a front runner of, like, Title IX enforcement. That university actually set a lot of standards now, because they had to, as part of the settlement, they had to change their policies. So it was very, very important to the plaintiffs that the university changed what they do. So they changed what they did, and it improved them vastly. For example, the fact that there are Title IX coordinators at schools, that didn't happen before. So if there is a violation, a student or a faculty member or anyone can go and rectify it. The fact that this is a federal law is backed up in reality now. So it set a precedent for the law. And I know that feel like if you're not a lawyer, you're like, whatever. But really, it did enable all those other cases to happen. So, you know, the plaintiffs, their lives were turned upside down. But, I have to think that they feel proud of what they accomplished. You know, if I were them, I would feel incredible. I feel like, well, that's a huge contribution I made to women, really, and to society. You know, what I hope the book will do, honestly, is shine a light on this case. This case was amazing. It changed everything. It, you know, lawyers knew about it, but I've seen books since then about Title IX sexual assault that have never mentioned this case ever. So, and I'm like, how could you not even know about this case? This is the case that started everything. And from then, everything changed. So I really wanted people to know about it and what these people accomplished, what these women did to change life for the rest of us. You know, I think it's changed a little bit of the idea, like winning a game is not and should not be more important than a woman's life. I'm hoping there was a value shift in the community.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming up on this afternoon's Metro Show, host Miriam Schiff speaks to Jennifer Bancroft, healthcare expert, about how corporations are failing to support exhausted frontline healthcare workers.
At the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, I spoke with Jennifer Bancroft about what it was like and what she was experiencing in both her employment and the community. Today, almost 3 years later, what has the medical profession improved on and learned? What has our community at large learned? And what has she learned? Jennifer holds a master's in social work and is an RN with a specialty in geriatrics. She works in both the acute hospital setting as well as long-term care. She is the president of Compassionate Humanity Foundation, a foundation that focuses on social injustice advocacy and reform. You can contact Jennifer at jbancroft, B-A-N-K-C-R-O-F-T, compassionatehumanity@yahoo.com. Thank you for joining me today again, Jennifer.
Hi, Mary. It's so good to see you again.
There is so much that we can talk about. On past shows, guests have been talking about trauma and the possible holding of the trauma, like post-traumatic stress disorder. You are walking down the same hallways, possibly going into the same patient rooms. What has it been like for you and for the other frontline workers?
It's, I think, even in the last year, it's been even harder. Support has waned, especially from the corporations we work for. Staffing has gotten shorter and shorter. We've had so many coworkers that have left the profession. And, you know, and if they haven't left, they're just doing it as needed when they feel like it because they're exhausted. I myself just started acupuncture about 6 months ago. It took me a while to realize that I was having post-traumatic stress and it was significantly affecting me. And luckily, a good friend and my wife had alerted me to that. And I've since gotten help. But, you know, it's just been the longest 3 years I've ever had. I've been in this profession for 40 years and I've never seen it this short. I've never seen people so tired. And, you know, I'm truly concerned where we're going to go from here as far as a profession, because I don't see the shortage changing anytime soon. I have reached out to the state representatives over and over in 3 years, begging them to give some incentives to entice people to come into this profession, to keep people in the profession. And to provide some kind of support, you know, mentally, because there really is not that much outreach. At the first, there was a lot of people volunteering their time, psychiatrists, therapists, and that waned off very quickly. There's a few places in Denver that still do, but besides just paying for your own private therapy, there's really nothing out there support-wise for nurses. A lot of us have created groups and done things to really support each other. But as far as the corporations behind us or anything like that, it's just not there. And it's truly sad.
They blanked out what you went through and it's business as usual for them because they weren't there. And the bottom line, if it's corporation, we all know that the bottom line is corporations rely on their bottom line, which is money.
They do, but you know, as I've watched for my 40 years, is that they're not very smart about their bottom line, because now they are paying travel nurses $5,000 a week. That doesn't seem like a smart bottom line to me. You know, yeah, maybe you're not paying health insurance for these people or workman's comp. You know, you're saving some money, but in the long run, you can't possibly be saving money. It's not going to work long term. I guarantee that. And you don't get the quality of care that you should for patients. You just don't. These are, you know, most of the nurses that my wife had when she was in the hospital, every single one of them was a travel nurse except one. And they were young people that just came out here to hike or, you know, ski. And then they were on to the next thing. They weren't poor quality nurses, but they weren't invested. You need people that are invested in your company and in a patient's long-term health. And you're not going to get that with travel people.
You use the word invested. I can still see the pictures of the frontline workers. You're trained to heal. You're trained, you heal them, you talk to them, you develop a relationship with them. They go home, they're healthy. or they don't go home, you're invested with them. It's a relationship.
It's an amazing relationship, yes.
That's coming up on today's Metro Show at 3 p.m.
And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I have been your host, Rosanna Longobetter. Special thanks to Ellie Stackrath, CU Boulder CMCI student Maddie Mueller, the CityCast Denver crew, Miriam Schiff, for their contributions to today's program, and Alexis Kenyon for her production support. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower, and then it's Good Old CU with Joe Juhas. That's just after these news headlines from the BBC.